From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Is your telephone bill too complicated to decipher? Are you unsure which long-distance carrier is the best? Is shopping for a telephone giving you a headache? Today on Fresh Air, some advice from consumer advocate Carl Opedal. He just compiled Consumer Reports' new book on telephone service and equipment. Freelance reporter Frank Smythe was traveling with the Kurds when their rebellion was put down by the Iraqi military. Smythe was captured by the Iraqis and held prisoner for 17 days. His colleague, the German photographer Gad Gross, was shot and killed by an Iraqi soldier. Coming up, Smythe tells us the story. That and more on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The widow of assassinated Indian leader Rajiv Gandhi today turned down an offer to take his place as head of the Congress Party. Sonia Gandhi was unanimously chosen to lead the party through the remainder of India's general elections, which were postponed for 3 weeks after the assassination. Some observers said it was hoped that the Italian-born widow could help capture a sympathy vote for the party. Mrs. Gandhi's decision not to take the post leaves the Congress Party without a clear leader, dimming its prospects for winning the general elections. Secretary of State James Baker returned to Capitol Hill today for more testimony on his attempts to set up peace talks between the Arabs and the Israelis. He spent most of his time defending his statement yesterday that nothing has complicated his efforts more than the expansion of Israeli settlements. Barry Schwide has more.
For Baker, it was a frustrating morning. He tried to balance his criticism of Israel with criticism of the Arabs' economic boycott and their state of belligerence with Israel. But Baker was on the defensive throughout the testimony, especially since he offered no concrete hope of breaking the boycott or what he called the taboos. Baker didn't even try to defend Syrian President Hafez Assad, who was likened by Senator Alphonse D'Amato of New York to Saddam Hussein, only far more capable. The senators clearly were unhappy with Baker's criticism of Israel, and they suggested he was making a diplomatic mistake, giving the Arabs reason to dig their heels in and to refuse to come to terms with the Jewish state. Frustrated, Baker suggested at one point to D'Amato that the senator get Israel to halt settlements, and he, Baker, would work the Arab side of the street, trying to end the economic boycott. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
President Bush today declined to say whether he favors providing the Soviet Union with massive economic aid. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev says his country needs $100 billion in aid from the West, but today President Bush said he hasn't seen an official request from the Soviet leader, adding, $100 billion is a large piece of change.
Soviet Union is a great power. We deal with them with respect. We have problems with them, but it is in our interest. It is in the national security interest of the United States, and I think in every other interest, to have a reformed Soviet Union.
The president was equally vague on arms control, although he said there is some room for optimism. If an arms control agreement is ironed out, then a summit is likely, but the president declined to say when that might happen. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Stock prices were down today on Wall Street, pushed down by what analysts said was a program sell-off before the holiday weekend. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 10 points to close at 2,900. Declines edged advances in active trading. Volume was 173 million shares. This is NPR News. Officials at the United Nations announced today that Iraq has agreed to allow a UN police force to provide security for Kurdish refugees in northern Iraq. The agreement was signed today by UN and Iraqi authorities in Baghdad. Under the plan, as many as 500 UN guards or police will replace allied troops in northern Iraq. Their mission will be to protect Kurdish refugees as they return to their homes from the Turkish and Iranian borders. Mexican officials say they're encouraged by today's House decision to extend President Bush's fast-track authority to negotiate a free trade agreement with Mexico. The Senate is expected to vote on the measure within the next few days. Sandina Robbins reports from Mexico City.
The government of President Salinas views today's vote in the U.S. Congress as a major victory. Since Mexico already has fast-tracked, the Salinas administration has pushed for a closed negotiation process with its northern neighbors. But not all free trade supporters here agree that Congress should stay on the sidelines. Congressman Demetrio Sodi of Mexico's ruling party.
You can assure that in 1 year or 1 year and a half, we're going to have an agreement. But the point right now is what kind of agreement. And that's why all the congressmen in the States and the congressmen in Mexico, we have to want more detailed information.
Congressman Sodi is optimistic that elected officials from the three countries will participate. But critics to free trade here say that judging from the U.S.-Canadian free trade agreement, once again, the talks will take place behind closed doors. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
A co-defendant in the drug case against Manuel Noriega has agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. An attorney for Brian Davido confirmed that his client has agreed to enter into a plea bargain. Davido was convicted on 2 drug trafficking counts in March and faces a maximum of 40 years in prison. The government claims that he and another defendant conspired in a drug deal with Noriega when Noriega was in power in Panama. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I remember when making choices about telephones was simple. Ma Bell was your only choice in phone companies. As for telephones, well, you could choose your color and whether to get a desk phone, a wall phone, or a princess. And now we have enough choices in telephones, answering machines, and long-distance carriers to drive us crazy. I think my guest will be of some help. Carl Opedal is the author of a new guide to phone service and equipment. It's called The Phone Book, and it's published by Consumer Reports. Let's start with the area that confuses me the most, long-distance service.
Well, in the area of long-distance service, I think a lot of people wonder whether it's worth their time and their trouble to even bother to compare the different long-distance companies. The fact is that if all you cared about was price, and if you only made $20 or $30 or $40 worth of long-distance calls every month, it's probably not worth your trouble to try to do better on price. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be thinking about which carrier you're using, and that's because some carriers have better connections than others. And I'm hoping that during this program we'll have a chance to talk about ways that you can compare one carrier to the next without having to sign up for them.
You suggested that if you make under, what, about $40 a month of long-distance phone calls, it's not worth switching to one of the newer companies to save money. What are the other reasons to switch? Sound quality?
It's important to know that at all times you can use any of half a dozen different long-distance carriers. This is in part because one of them may have better sound quality than the next. It is also very important because sometimes you could get a situation where your calls just don't go through. A couple of years ago, for example, there was the earthquake in San Francisco. Everybody, of course, was on the telephones calling up their friends and relatives in the Bay Area trying to find out if they were okay. Most people were signed up for AT&T or MCI or Sprint, and none of them were able to get through. But all these people could have used any of several other long-distance carriers, including ITT. I happened to try using ITT that day, and I got through with no trouble at all. You do this by using 5-digit access codes, 5-digit codes that allow you to use any long-distance carrier you want at a moment's notice. You don't have to sign up for them in advance, and then you can get through if one of the other ones is busy, and you can find out for yourself which ones have good phone connections.
Now, how does that work? You have to know this 5-digit access code. Is there a standard code, or is there a different one for every city?
Well, thank goodness the numbers that I'm about to describe work the same all across the country. Suppose you dial a long-distance call, and you get a bad connection.
Mm-hmm.
What you did, of course, you dialed 1 in the area code and the telephone number. And if you got a bad connection, and if you do what most of us, I think, have always done out of habit, you hang up the phone, you pick it up, and you dial exactly the same thing again. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. If you get a bad connection, hang up the phone, pick it up, and dial one of these 5-digit prefixes. 10222 is MCI, 10288 is AT&T, 10333 is U.S. Sprint, 10488 is ITT, 10444 is AllNet. You dial one of those 5-digit prefixes, and then you dial 1 in the area code and the telephone number, and suddenly your call will go through on completely different circuits on a different long-distance carrier. And if your first connection was a bad one, the second one is unlikely to be a bad connection because you're not even using the same facilities to make the call.
Now, I'm going to suggest to our listeners that they get a pencil because I'm going to ask you to give those numbers again in a second. But let's explain this a little more. With this access code, you can make 1 phone call on MCI or Sprint or ITT and test it either for sound quality or use it to get access to a line that you can't get through on the carrier that you have.
That's exactly right. And another example of how these can be handy is if you're making an overseas call. It happens pretty often, depending on which overseas country you might be calling, that you can't get through because all the circuits to that country are busy. And of course, what this means is all the circuits to that country allocated to your primary carrier are busy. But if you use one of these five-digit prefixes, your call could go through and perhaps get through because there are lines available to one of the other long-distance carriers.
Is there a special charge if you use it?
The amount that you'll pay, you'll get a bill eventually for all these calls. This is not something that gives you free calls. The amount you'll pay will be about the same as what you would have paid if you had switched over to that carrier in the first place. And these prices tend to be quite consistent with the prices you're used to in any event.
Okay, I think our listeners have their pencils now. Let me ask you to give those five-digit codes again.
That's right. The here they are in no particular order. U.S. Sprint is 10333. MCI is 10222, ITT is 10488, Allnet is 10444, and AT&T is 10288.
So you dial that and then 1 in your area code?
You dial that and then whatever else it is that you were going to dial. For a domestic long-distance call, you would dial 1 in the area code and the phone number after the 5-digit prefix. For an international call, you would dial 011 and the number after the 5-digit prefix.
Now, let's get back to rates. Everybody's very confused about rates. At what point, if you have AT&T, at what point does it make sense to look to the other plans to save money?
Well, if you make a lot of calls to a particular foreign country, or if your monthly bill is regularly over perhaps $50 or $60 a month, or if you make a lot of calls to a particular city or state within the U.S. over, say, $50 or so, you would be smart to call up each of the carriers one by one and ask them what special program they have. Because each of the carriers, AT&T, MCI, Sprint, for example, have special programs that that might save you money.
Are they all discounted at about the same? I mean, is one any more obviously cheaper than the other?
Well, as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, MCI and Sprint, for example, were always a lot cheaper than AT&T. AT&T has been cutting its rates pretty consistently so that by now it is almost down to the levels of those other carriers. So if you just took any single phone call and tried to compare rates, you wouldn't see an enormous striking difference amongst the several carriers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carl Opedal, and he's the chief author of a new consumer reports book called The Phone Book, and it's about telephone equipment and telephone service. A lot of people have been buying telephones now instead of renting them from the phone company. What do you think are the relative advantages to buying or renting?
It is, as recently as 10 years ago, almost everyone rented all their phones from their local phone company. Today, I like to think that everybody simply uses phones that they have purchased. But what's really remarkable is that in the state of New York, for example, fully 1/8 of all the telephone customers in the state continue to rent their phones now from AT&T, since after the breakup, they came to be the owners of those phones. I think the smart consumer will do everything it takes to make sure that all the telephones in the house or in the office are the kind that can be unplugged easily rather than the kind that are connected straight into the wall. And any phones that are being rented, the consumer ought to buy those phones, buy them from AT&T or give them back to AT&T and buy other phones. It's not smart consumerism to continue renting any telephones.
Why not?
It just doesn't make sense in terms of money. The cost to rent telephones is so much that you could buy phones and throw them away every year and still spend less money than if you keep renting them.
You know, I still think, though, that those old AT&T rotary telephones have the best sound.
There is no question that the telephones that many of us knew when we were little kids, phones that came from the phone company and said Western Electric on them, were sturdy and still are sturdy right now. There's no question about that. And if you have a phone that's been giving you good service, buy it from AT&T, but don't keep renting it.
Is there any advantage in buying telephones with the phone company logos on them? Or are they going to be any better sound quality than to buy, you know, another brand name?
I think the thing to do there is to really give very little significance to a telephone company logo on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these purchases are for a relatively small amount of money, $20 or $30 or $40. And, you know, if you're buying a toaster or something, I don't think you'd pay extra for a toaster that came from your electric company. I think the thing to do is, you know, if you have a phone that a friend of yours has used and it served them well, maybe buy that kind of phone read Consumer Reports magazine, for example, and get ratings of telephones. But I would not particularly give emphasis to a telephone company name on the telephone.
Yeah, I asked that because since the old telephone company phones have such good sound quality, I wanted to know if we should expect that from the phones that are being marketed with the phone company logos on them.
Well, even the phones that you'd get from AT&T, they're not really made the same way that those old reliable phones were made. Different manufacturing processes are used and different construction techniques, so it wouldn't be fair to hold them up to the same expectation.
Now, if you're going from a rotary phone to a touch tone phone, do you have to get the phone company to make a conversion for you?
Well, yes, you're right to be asking that. If you get a telephone with push buttons on it, it'll probably have a little switch that allows you to select between tone and pulse. And if it's in the pulse position, those buttons will do the same thing that a rotary telephone would have done. And that can be plugged in the same place where a rotary phone could be, and you don't have to make any special arrangement with your phone company. But if you flip the switch over to the tone position so that that telephone is producing tones, you should try plugging it in, and if it works, that's fine. But if it doesn't work, it probably is because your local telephone company would have to be supplying what's called touch-tone line treatment on your telephone line. I've been an advocate for years that that is not something that should be costing extra. It turns out it's actually bad for the telephone network for everybody to be using rotary because they tie up the circuits more when they're first dialing the call. I published an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago, which I like to think may have influenced the changes in Oregon and Utah and California to make touch-tone something that does not cost extra. And I hope eventually it'll be that way across the country.
When we say cost extra, do we mean a couple of dollars or more than that?
Well, it varies greatly from state to state. But in New York, for example, touch-tone is more than a dollar a month. And I don't think it should be that way.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about cordless telephones. If you're going to buy one, you'll notice that there's one channel, there's multi-channel. What's the difference?
Well, the cordless telephones that are now commonly available in stores are phones that will be marked with a particular numerical designation. They will say 4649, which is a way of saying that the frequencies the cordless phones use are 46 megahertz and 49 megahertz. There are 10 channels available in that area for cordless use. Not every cordless phone uses all 10 channels. Some only use one channel, some use two channels. If you're in an area that is very crowded, in an urban area, for example, I think it would be smart to get the kind of phone that can use any of the 10 channels. And in fact, there are some cordless phones that automatically scan through all 10 channels every time you pick them up to find out which ones are not in use. If, on the other hand, you're in a rural area, an area that's not so crowded, you might find that you wouldn't get any interference from your neighbors no matter which channel you use.
If you live in an apartment building where your radio and TV reception isn't very good, are you likely to get bad reception on a cordless phone as well?
No. In fact, in an odd way, you're likely to be happier with the results. The walls of the building that make it hard for you to pick up the radio and the television are also going to make it more difficult for your neighbor's cordless phone to interfere with yours. So in an odd way, you might actually be better off.
Now, you recommend that if you're only going to have one phone in your house, it should not be a cordless phone.
Well, that's right. Most cordless phones have to be plugged into the wall to function. And imagine the situation where you have a loss of electric power, perhaps due to a storm or some sort of natural disaster. It would be a pity if that meant that your cordless phone didn't work anymore. Next thing you know, you can't make any phone calls. I would say at least one phone in the house should be the kind of phone that does not have to be plugged into the wall.
About how much do you have to spend to buy a cordless phone that will actually sound good?
That's a very tough question, and it depends how many people who are physically nearby to you are likely to be using cordless phones, because they're going to interfere with your ability to get a good connection. There is no substitute for buying it and bringing it home and trying it in the place where you plan to use it, and I sure hope the place where you bought it is the kind of place that would let you exchange it if you weren't happy with the results.
That's a good thing to inquire about before you pay.
That's right.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Carl Opedal. He's the chief author of a new Consumer Reports book about buying phones, about phone systems, and the book is called The Phone Book. More about phones after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carl Opedal, author of the new book, The Phone Book, How to Get the Telephone Equipment and Service You Want. And it's published by Consumer Reports. Let me ask you about cellular phones. More and more people seem to be buying them or thinking about them. Are the prices coming down?
Prices are certainly coming down. I think you'll find if you open up a newspaper or listen to an advertisement, you'll find that there are two prices. And the price that's advertised is a price that assumes you're signing up for service. And then there's a much higher price you'd have to pay if you just wanted to buy it and stick it in a box and never use it. This difference in price comes from a sales commission that a cellular carrier is going to pay to that store in return for their signing you up for that company's service. And those commissions continue to be very high, typically $300. And the actual cost of the hardware is coming way down. A car phone these days can often be had for as little as $100, and a nice handheld cellular telephone, a so-called portable phone, can easily be gotten for $300 or $400.
So the main problem isn't so much the phone as it is the billing.
Well, I think most customers haven't the faintest idea until after they start getting the bills what they're in for. One problem, of course, is that the bills, you tend to spend a lot of money on a cellular telephone. $100 a month or more is a typical bill. But I think one of the things that most of our listeners probably don't realize is that it's important to be smart about which of the two cellular carriers in your city you would be connected to. Each city that has cellular service has two carriers, and each carrier makes its own decisions about where to put the antennas that will make connections with your cellular phone. And it's possible to imagine that depending on where you live, where you work, where you go when you're using the cellular phone, one carrier or the other might happen to be better situated to give you service. Now, there's no way you could ever know this by consulting the salesperson at the store where you buy the phone. And you couldn't even tell it by looking at maps that show where they claim to have coverage. The only way to do it is to try both carriers. And now I'm going to say something that sounds like bad news but is actually good news. What I'm going to recommend is that anybody who gets a new cellular phone, whether it's a car phone or a handheld portable cellular phone, should simply sign up for both carriers in the city they're in. This costs a certain amount of money. You have to pay a subscription fee for each of those carriers for the couple of months that you would do the testing I'm about to describe. But if you do this, and these phones all have a little switch that allows them to go back and forth between two carriers or more, if you try it out, you'll find out, perhaps, that one of the carriers often has circuits busy because everybody's trying to make a call at the same time you are, and maybe the other one does not have circuits that are busy. Or maybe one of them has better connections than another, or one of them has places where they can't even provide service because of where they chose to put their antennas. And after a month or so of comparing the two, you could find out which one actually serves you best and then drop the other one. That sounds like bad news because you're paying subscription fees to two companies, but it's actually good news because if you make clear to the store where you're buying this that you're going to sign up for two carriers, they will get two sales commissions and they will be able to drop their price to you, taking into account both commissions. With a car phone, you could probably get it free, and with a handheld portable, you could probably knock off at least an extra $100 in the price of the telephone.
So if you're going to do that, you should walk into the store prepared to negotiate.
Walk into the store, explain to them that you're going to want both carriers for some period of time, and ask them what they can do in terms of giving you the benefit of the two sales commissions.
I found out from your book that you actually pay to have an unlisted number. I didn't realize you get charged for that.
Well, it varies from one state to the next because each phone company in every state is regulated by a different state regulator, and the regulators vary from one to the next in how they handle these things. But generally speaking, having a number that's not printed in the phone book or having a number that does not is not made available through directory assistance does cost extra. But what usually does not cost extra, and for some people this would be just as good, is that many phone companies will leave out the address for your listing out of the phone book at no charge. And I think for a lot of people, if you think about what it is that you're trying to avoid, concern about privacy, for example, just leaving out the address is sometimes all you really wanted, and that's free usually.
If you're just joining us, Carl Opedal is my guest, author of the new book, The Phone Book, published by Consumer Reports. I'm sure a lot of our listeners spend a fair amount of time in hotels and know how expensive it is to call out from a hotel. I mean, in cities, you usually get charged a minimum of 75 cents, often a dollar or more, just to make that call. That's not even, I mean, that's just for making the call. That's not even the charge for the amount of time you're on the phone. And there's often, you know, a hotel surcharge per minute for the amount of time that you call. Are there ways of circumventing the hotel surcharges?
I think with hotel telephones and also with privately owned public telephones, there is a great potential for customers to get burned, getting charged a lot more than they expected for long-distance calls, as you correctly point out. In the case of hotels, there are a couple of things that you can consider. One is if you use a calling card from Sprint or MCI, those calling cards have a way that you can make a call that starts by dialing an 800 number, and after that, then you dial some other digits. And in some hotels, the 800 numbers don't have surcharges. So if you're in one of those hotels, that provides a very good way to make long-distance calls and not get burned. Some hotels, it annoys me every time I have it happen to me, still charge a lot of money even for an 800 number call, which is ridiculous because it costs them nothing to put through that call. But if you're in one of those hotels, sometimes I've gotten to where I just go down to the lobby and use the payphone in the lobby just to avoid having to pay what is sometimes an exorbitant surcharge, even for the 800 number that starts the calling card process.
The number of pages in our phone bills have just skyrocketed recently. And I don't know, I feel like to really be a good consumer here would take like half of your life. So looking at local charges for a second, do you have any advice for us about how to figure out how to interpret the local part of the phone bill and if there's often special plans we should be considering?
With the local part of your telephone bill, one of the things you need to do is make sure that you understand each of the charges that makes up the standard monthly service charge. And you may have to call your local business office to get them to explain the charges one by one. Figure out which ones are optional and which ones can be left off. And that's one of the first steps you should follow. It varies greatly from one state to the next in terms of what your options are. For some people, for example, if you make a lot of local calls, it might make sense to pay extra for a plan where local calls are not charged extra. But in some places, that's not available. In some places, the only way you can sign up is with a plan where every local call costs money.
One last thing. This is just a handy bit of information. I think we've all been in the situation where we desperately needed somebody's unlisted number and we couldn't get it. And there's actually a way to get it if you really need it.
That's right. Every directory assistance office, and they don't publicize this, of course, because otherwise they'd get far more business than they can handle. Every directory assistance office always has a bureau that handles inquiries about unlisted numbers. If you call directory assistance and if you have a genuine emergency, you should only do this if it's a genuine emergency, you explain this to them, and they won't give you the person's number. That'll never happen. But they will offer to take down a message from you and pass it along to the subscriber. Now, this is only available if you got your unlisted number by paying for it. A lot of people who want to have what they consider to be the privacy benefits of an unlisted number will try to get it by simply subscribing under a made-up name, a fictitious name. If they do that, obviously this unlisted bureau is not going to be any help to them.
Carl Obadal is the editor of The Phone Book, published by Consumer Reports. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You said you love me, baby. Please call me on the phone sometime. You said you love me, baby. Please call me on the phone sometime. When I hear your voice, yeah, I know it eased my worried mind. One of these days.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When the war in the Gulf ended, reporter Frank Smythe and several other journalists illegally entered Iraq to cover the Kurdish rebellion. When the rebels were attacked by Iraqi troops, Smythe was taken prisoner by the Iraqis. Gad Gross, a photographer on assignment for Newsweek, was shot and killed. Coming up, a talk with Smythe about his own capture and the death of his friend and colleague. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg coins a new term, cacophonism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld federal regulations barring doctors at federally funded family planning clinics from counseling women about abortions in any way. The vote was 5-4, with the newest justice, David Souter, providing the fifth and critical vote. The court's only female justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, dissented. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1970, Congress passed a law banning the use of federal funds for abortion. 18 years later, the Reagan administration adopted regulations that went much further than ever before in implementing the statute. The administration barred any family clinic that receives federal money from even talking about abortion to its patients, even if a patient asked about abortion. Doctors also were forbidden to refer pregnant patients to abortion clinics. Doctors and family planning clinics challenged the regulations in court, claiming they violated their right of free speech. Today, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, upheld the regulations. Writing for the court majority, Chief Justice William Rehnquist said that since the federal government may favor childbirth over abortion, it may also forbid the use of federal funds for speech that promotes abortion. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
On Capitol Hill, the House has voted to give the president wide leeway to work out a tariff-cutting trade treaty with Mexico. The vote was 231-192, and is a victory for the Bush administration, which has wanted authority to make trade agreements with the least amount of congressional interference. The question is now before the Senate. At issue is whether to continue for 2 years the so-called fast-track trade authority for the president. In India, the widow of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi has turned down the presidency of the Congress Party, which her late husband led until he was murdered this week. Julian Crandall-Hollick reports from New Delhi.
Sonia Gandhi's refusal to accept the Congress Party presidency appears to have taken most Congress Party officials by surprise. In a short statement this evening, Mrs. Gandhi gave no reason for her decision, which throws the whole issue of whether Congress can survive without a Gandhi at the helm back into question just 3 weeks before the final voting takes place in India's suspended elections. There was little official reaction this evening from Congress party leaders, but a party spokesman on television suggested the decision might not be irrevocable. But unless Mrs. Gandhi reconsiders in the next few days, it seems all but impossible for the Congress party to convince wavering voters that it alone can provide the political stability this wounded country so desperately needs. From New Delhi, this is Julian Crandall-Hollick reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 10 points to close at 2,904 on volume of 173 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News. President Bush says that all options are open when it comes to calls from Soviet leader Gorbachev to be allowed to speak at a July financial summit meeting in London. Mr. Bush also said that there will be a wide range of diplomatic efforts with Western allies before that meeting in order to reach agreement on Moscow's call for aid to the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet leader has not directly put a price to his aid package. He told a news conference this week that other nations should be willing to pay $100 billion to solve a crisis. In New York City, the UN Security Council may issue a statement condemning the latest round of deportations of Palestinians by Israel. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more on the story.
The seven non-aligned members of the UN Security Council today circulated a draft of a resolution condemning the recent deportations and demanding that those affected be safely returned to Israel. The resolution would declare the actions a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which protects civilians in wartime. The United States has already condemned the deportations, but U.S. officials are opposing the non-aligned proposal. Instead, they want to issue a presidential statement, which is considered less binding than a resolution. The four men, who were all from the Gaza Strip, were deported from Israel over the weekend. Israel had maintained that they were activists in the Fatah movement of the PLO. The Security Council will convene again Friday to take up the matter. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
And the government says that new claims for unemployment benefits were down slightly in early May. According to the Labor Department, 454,000 people had first-time claims for unemployment in the week ending May 11th. This was down 5,000 from the week before. This drop brought the average weekly rate of new claims over the last 4 weeks to 467,000, down from 478,000. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The journalist Gad Gross died March 29th, covering the aftermath of the war in the Gulf. My guest Frank Smythe heard the shots that killed him. Smythe, Gross, and several other journalists entered Iraq illegally at the end of the war to cover the Kurdish rebellion. Smythe is a freelancer who was on assignment for The Village Voice, CBS News Radio, and The Economist. Gad Gross was a 27-year-old German photographer on assignment for Newsweek. The Kurdish uprising was at its peak when they arrived in northern Iraq. When the rebellion was put down by Iraqi soldiers, the journalists literally ran for their lives. Smythe says Gad Gross hid in a house with the Kurd who had been their guide. Both were killed. Smythe hid in a ditch with French photographer Alan Bou. They were taken prisoner by Iraqi soldiers and held for 17 days. We invited Smythe to tell us the story of his captivity and the murder of his friend. Smythe says the thought he might be captured never crossed his mind because he was confident the Iraqi army was broken and the Kurdish rebellion would succeed.
We entered with the Kurds and we traveled almost 200 miles south with them over a period of 9 days. We saw no sign whatsoever of the Iraqi army, with the exception of some Iraqi soldiers who were walking freely in the city of Arbil, having already surrendered to the Kurds. They controlled the entire area of northern Iraq and Kurdistan, and certainly the only sign of resistance we saw was a helicopter firing on one day near Mosul until we got to the southern limit of the rebellion, which was Kirkuk. But certainly the north, Saddam's regularly deployed army had completely collapsed, and the Kurds were in complete control of the situation. In fact, the question wasn't whether or not the Kurds would succeed, but how much time Saddam had left.
When did you start to feel the situation turn?
Well, when we got to Kirkuk, we were on the front line, and it seemed at least there that there was something left of Saddam's army. 2 miles outside the city, the paratroopers had set up a line of defense along with tanks, and they appeared to be holding their own. They weren't attacking the Kurds, but were holding their own. My impression at the time was that these units had been ordered there by Saddam Hussein, but they didn't have the morale to actually go out and attack, because the Kurds, while we were there, were engaging these forces from a distance, and certainly the Kurds controlled the city, and Saddam at that time seemed like he still had some troops left, but was relatively weak. Of course, that was a terrible mistake. In fact, Saddam was merely biding his time to launch a major counteroffensive. That took place on the morning of March 28th. It was at that time, it wasn't until the 28th, we were captured the following morning. It wasn't until the 28th that the tide really began to turn and the counteroffensive began. Of course, then they rolled through Kirkuk and retook the rest of Kurdistan, Saddam's army, within a matter of 4 days.
Now, you were surprised to find out that the Kurds had no idea how to use a lot of the weapons that they had captured. Is that unusual for a rebel group?
Well, the problem with the Kurds is that they weren't a rebel group with a lot of experience. The Kurds had fought for decades against the Turks as well as inside Iraq and in Iran. But this rebellion began March 14th at the end of the Gulf War. And 9 out of 10 Kurdish men who were armed had never previously carried a gun and had no experience. So the problem was you had a lot of very eager people armed with light AK-47 assault rifles as well as rocket-propelled grenades, but they simply didn't know how to use the tanks, the anti-aircraft guns, and other heavy artillery that they had captured from the Iraqi army. Also, there was an organizational problem. You had groups of hundreds of Kurdish rebels waiting for orders, but they weren't deployed in a guerrilla sense. There wasn't really a command structure of competent leaders, at least not enough of them, to really handle this great influx of men, which really increased tenfold in a matter of weeks.
Were the Kurds looking out for you?
Yes, very much so. We had a guide with us, Batyar, who was killed along with Gad. They very much were concerned for our safety and our well-being. At the same time, they recognized that we wanted to be at the front and we wanted to cover the story. Of course, at the time, if the front was going to move anywhere, they thought it would be further south. No one expected that Kirkuk would be retaken so easily by the Iraqi army and then the rest of Kurdistan.
When did you realize that it was time for you to run for your lives?
Well, the morning of the 28th, we were sleeping in a oil refinery building, and Kurdish commanders came in and said, look, it's time to go. The shelling was very heavy and was coming closer to where we were sleeping than it had come over the past 3 days. We went to the downtown area, and that seemed relatively quiet. But over the course of 2 hours, the shelling increased there. We went out with some Kurdish rebels towards the southern edge of the city who were going to engage some Iraqi tanks. And then it became very clear that these people didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have the experience. They would go on top of a house, for instance, and set up counterberry fire against the tanks. And within a matter of minutes, I watched literally as a shell just ripped the house to shreds. By that point, we knew we had to get out of the city. We were hoping to be able to go back downtown and retrieve our packs. It didn't take long before we realized that we'd have to abandon the packs and try to get them at a later date. The problem was when we finally did go out of the city, the Kurds said, look, just get a car and we'll drive north, and soon you'll be back in Arbil and you'll be out of danger. What they didn't know is the Iraqi army had set up an ambush, and rather than attacking from the west and the south in the city, had circled around to the north and was in the process of cutting the road to Arbil. So we literally drove north directly into an ambush at a time when the Kurds said that, or they thought, that the army was only in the south and west of the city.
My guest is journalist Frank Smythe. While covering the Kurdish rebellion, he was taken hostage by Iraqi soldiers. His colleague, photographer Gad Gross, was killed. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is freelance reporter Frank Smythe. He and photographer Gad Gross covered the Kurdish rebellion in northern Iraq following the Gulf War. When you fled from the Iraqi army, you ended up separated from Gad Gross. Can you tell the story of where you ended up and how that happened?
We were driving north. We were going to try to make it all the way through to Arbil, but it became very clear as we came up over this pass that we were driving into literally a wall of fire. To the left of us, there was a pickup truck that had crashed. The driver was slumped over the wheel. He had been shot. There was a bus that had taken a hit from a shell that was completely demolished. Body pieces were strewn about the road. And there was machine gun fire coming over in a very steady stream across the road itself. So we abandoned the vehicle and wound up behind a house. Our driver was someone we were hitchhiking with. He drove further into the terrain by mistake. We wound up trapped behind this house with bullets literally flying all around us, thousands of them. And at the same time, the Iraqi army was using Kikucha rockets, which is a flatbed truck that fires up to 40 missiles in succession. They were landing on fields behind us, making it almost impossible to run. We had seen a column of tanks descend from a mountain pass about 200 or 300 yards away, But now he turned, and there were two tanks coming right at us, about 50, little more than 50 yards from us, coming right in our direction. Gad and Bahtiyar, our Kurdish guide, started to run first, and they veered behind a house. Alan and I were slightly behind them. We looked over our shoulder, and we thought we saw the tank turret turning in our direction. We could see the tank clearly. We thought the tank had seen us. We thought there was going to be a shell coming in at any moment. Gad and Bahtiyar veered right behind the house. We saw a ditch a little bit to the left, and we just dove right in it. We then wound up staying in the ditch for 18 hours, and we never saw Gad or Bahtiyar again.
How did you know that Gad Gross was killed?
We were hiding in the ditch. We had spent the night in the ditch. The last we had seen Gad and Bahtiyar was between 2 and 3 in the afternoon the day before. We weren't sure if they had were able to run away or to steal away in the night. They were further from the road, further from the tanks than we were. We thought maybe they might have had a chance. But in the morning, the soldiers were all around us throughout the night. I mean, very close. We could hear them walking. We could hear them talking. We could hear them opening cans of food. They were all around our position as well as around the house where we had last seen Gad and Bahtiyar. In the morning, we heard a soldier near the house, and all of a sudden this tremendous amount of commotion and banging as if they were banging against metal desks or something. And it was clear that they had discovered something or someone in the house. The soldier started yelling, a lot of commotion, a lot of anger. Many other soldiers came running over until there must have been, you know, at least 10 soldiers gathered at this house. They then started going through and just banging around the rest of the house, and it was clear that now they were searching the rest of the house, is what I thought at the time. And then we got, you know, more commotion and more anger, and it was clear that they had discovered someone else. It all took place, you know, in a matter of minutes, and it's Alan and I compared notes. We pretty much recall it in the same way, but it's very difficult to remember everything. But we know it was a matter of maybe 3 or 4 minutes that the whole incident took place. After the banging, I believe I heard a soldiers yelling, and it was clear that they were yelling at the people they had captured. I thought I heard a soldier yell, "Kurdi." There were some shots fired. We then heard a very loud, very strong, very powerful scream, which Alan and I both believe was certainly Gad. And it's not clear. I believe he was screaming because Bahtiyar had either already been killed or they were about to kill him. It was just a very strong scream of defiance. I don't think it was necessarily a scream of pain. There was a five-second delay and then another long burst of machine gun fire. The commotion died down, the soldiers stopped yelling, and then the situation returned to calm. An hour later, about 10 minutes later, Alan peeked over the edge of the ditch and saw a soldier carrying Gad's camera bag away from the house, so we knew that they had been involved in the incident. Then an hour later, a soldier was walking near the ditch where we were in. He glanced down. He saw us. Alan fortunately saw him. He jumped up and yelled, you know, "We're journalists." And later on, we saw Gad's camera bag. We saw identity papers with blood on it. And also soldiers told us, two officers told us, that he had killed himself because he had a gun.
You don't believe that? You don't believe he killed himself?
No, I don't believe that for a minute. Gad and I had discussed the concept of self-defense in a war zone, and Gad was adamant that a reporter under no circumstances should ever carry a weapon.
Why not?
Just because it compromises you, it compromises the profession, it's not your role. It probably would in the long term decrease rather than enhance your own security.
What went through your mind when you heard him shot?
Well, it was just, it was really shock. We were hiding in this ditch. We had been there the whole night. Soldiers are walking all around us. When we heard that, we realized that people had been discovered, I was hoping, well, maybe it's not them. And then once we heard the scream and heard the shots, we realized that it probably was them. And it was just a terrible feeling of shock and also some denial. When I was captured and we were brought to a gathering place where there were some other prisoners, I knew that Batiara was dead, but I was hoping to maybe see Gad, you know, maybe he'd been hit or something but was still alive. And then, of course, I was searching the area, hoping to come across him, and then my eyes sort of just fell upon his camera bag, and I knew then that that he was dead.
Did you think that you were going to be killed, too?
Absolutely. When we were captured, a soldier came up to me, and we were at gunpoint. We were told to put our hands higher. He searched my jacket. I couldn't get the zipper was stuck. It wasn't actually my jacket. It was Gad's. When I couldn't get it off, he pulled out a grenade and made like he was going to stick it inside the jacket. Another soldier, as we were walking out, we were, you know, petrified. Some of them spoke English, were saying, please, we're journalists, don't kill us. We said, where are we going? When they said, okay, come with us, because we were afraid we would be taken somewhere and executed. And a soldier looked at us and laughed. He understood what I said. And he said, you? And he drew his finger across his neck. About 10 minutes later, we were brought to see the captain, as he was described. He spoke English as well as another officer present. When we got there, the captain looked at us and he said, I want to take the gun and shoot you. He was very angry. We pleaded for our lives. There was a paratrooper officer who kept telling us, I kept saying, look, we're sorry, we're just journalists. He said, are you married? I said, you know, I lied. And I said, yes, I have a wife and 3 kids. And he said, I'm sorry, it's too late for you. So certainly we thought we were going to be killed. Also, there was another officer present at the time we were captured who I believe was a military liaison from the ruling Ba'ath Party. He kept reassuring us, no shoot, no shoot. At the same time, other officers were saying they were going to kill us, or other soldiers were saying they were going to kill us. And this officer later had a discussion, or an argument, I would say, with the paratrooper officer, in which I don't speak Arabic, but it was clear from the body language. The one officer was sort of making a case, and he was, you know, his body language was very opening, and he was clearly making some sort of point. And the other paratrooper officer was shaking his head. He pointed to Gad's identity card and then pretended to write on his hand and said the word Sahafi. So it was clear that he was saying, you know, Gad, this guy was executed. These guys are friends of his. They're journalists. They're going to write about it. And for that reason, we have to kill them. I think there was a genuine debate over what to do with us. Since there was a division, the officer in charge could make the decision by himself. So it had to be relayed to higher authorities. And fortunately, officers in the Iraqi army seem to be quite fearful of making decisions on their own where there might be repercussions. For that reason, as we understand, our case was eventually referred directly to Saddam Hussein, who made the decision himself.
Journalist Frank Smythe. On our next show, he'll tell us more about his captivity and release. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on today's Supreme Court decision?
Terry, it's a complicated decision involving both abortion rights and rights of free speech. Dina Totenberg's going to spend quite a bit of time analyzing it. We're also going to revisit India and see what is going to happen to the Congress Party now that Mrs. Gandhi has decided she does not want to head the party. Oregon is rationing health care. We're going to have a long takeout on that, and we're going to look at whether people in the kiss and ride lot do.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg often talks with us about the history and meaning of words, but today he's going to tell us about a new word that he made up.
It's been a long time since I heard anybody refer to cigarettes as coffin nails, but I see where a clever California entrepreneur has been doing a brisk business in a novelty brand called Death Cigarettes, with a package that shows a skull and the Surgeon General's warning in extra big letters. There seems to be no name for this when you call something by a word that makes it sound bad. What we want is the opposite of euphemism, which is formed from the Greek roots meaning good speech. That would be cacophemism, but I don't see any record that the word's ever been used. Well, it's got to start somewhere. Of course, euphemism is much more common than cacophonism. Human nature being what it is, we feel more need to put a nice face on things than an ugly one. Certain concepts seem to call up euphemisms in every language and every age. The Anglo-Saxons referred to death as the Elorsith, or journey elsewhere, pretty much like our passing away. But euphemism only flowers fully amongst the dense repressions of modern civilization. Ordinary life is so suffused with euphemism that we sometimes don't even recognize it unless we get an alien point of view. I know a Scandinavian who was visiting America and went into a store to buy some toilet paper. He brought a roll over to the clerk and said, "I don't understand. This says facial quality, but I want rectal quality." It's these same repressions that beget cacophonisms. The more daintily people trip around a topic, the more temptation there is to stick it to them. When middle-class people first began to use marijuana in the 1960s, they referred to it with words like grass and pot as part of an earnest effort to distinguish it from hard drugs like heroin. But as the drug culture became more assertive, people began to call marijuana by the old name dope, which conjured up all of the 1930s reefer madness stereotypes about narcotics. It set up a nice us-them distinction. After all, middle-aged people with pretensions to hipness could don flowered shirts and bell-bottom trousers. But they couldn't very well refer to marijuana as dope with the assurance that everybody else would understand that they were being ironic. This sort of thing often happens at a certain stage in the development of a social movement. It's going on now in the gay community, where some activists have gone back to the old epithets. There's a group called the Radical Fairies and the San Francisco lesbian motorcyclist who call themselves Dykes on Bikes. But most of the controversy surrounds a revival of the word queer. The group called Queer Nation was founded a while ago to combat gay bashing with a motto, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." The usage disturbs a lot of older members of the community who have fought for a long time to establish gay as a standard term. For them, words like queer and fairy are still tainted with the memories of persecution. But that's the point of cacophonisms. They throw stereotypes back in people's faces. Curiously, cacophonisms often have the same fate as euphemisms. They can lose their connotations and become just ordinary names for things. Head shrinker was introduced as a cacophonism for psychotherapist. But the shortened form shrink doesn't have disparaging overtones, maybe because people don't have to be diffident or defensive about being in therapy nowadays. And most of the people who call the TV the tube have forgotten that the expression originated as boob tube. That expression lost its ironic tinge once Knott's Landing became intellectually respectable. You'd like to think that attitudes about sexual preference would change in the same way, so that queer would have no more shock value than lefty.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, part two of our conversation with journalist Frank Smythe. While covering the Kurdish rebellion, he was captured by Iraqi soldiers and held prisoner for 17 days. A photographer he was traveling with, Gad Gross, was shot and killed by an Iraqi soldier. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.